I love a beautiful lawn. You love a beautiful lawn. Everybody loves a beautiful lawn, but they don't love how long it takes and how difficult it can be. And that is where True Green comes into play because it's the easiest and most affordable way to get that beautiful lawn. Let's be real. You've got plenty of other things to do in your free time than focus on your lawn care. So let True Green take care of all of that hard work while you get to do everything else that you want to do, like go play golf. Here's what you need to do. Visit truegreen.com, okay? It allows you to do you. Let them do the lawn care. And if you visit truegreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, that is all guaranteed. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. It's truegreen.com. Get started now. Welcome to the First Cut Podcast. I'm Rick Gaiman, and we're continuing our series of chatting with professional golfers because that's the best way to get all the possible information we could need. So before I bring in our guest today, let me bring in my partner in crime. It's Kyle Porter. Hey, Kyle.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm hanging. How are you?
I'm good. I'm enjoying this run of Pac-12 golfers that we've had.
Yes, this is good. This is so let's do it. Let's bring him in. So today, yeah, Kyle, you mentioned it, out of Stanford, Brandon Wu. Hey, Brandon.
Hey guys, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. How are you? Are you playing a lot of golf? What is your quarantine? What is your situation look like right now?
You know, so I actually haven't been playing that much golf. The courses have fortunately a few of them have been open here in Dallas. Trinity Forest has been open, which is where I play and practice at. But yeah, I haven't been playing too much, kind of just been hanging out. And this week I'm starting to get back a little bit more into it, starting to practice again and kind of get ready for the season to resume.
Where are you at in Dallas? I live in Dallas. I mean, I don't need your address, but just generally, like where are you living right now?
Yeah, I live in Uptown, so okay. It's a great area. I really enjoy it. I moved here probably right after the AT&T in February. Yeah, I've kind of been here ever since.
That's awesome. I live up in Richardson, so like probably 10 miles north of where you're at right now. Used to live down in kind of the Highland Park area. So
right, gotcha.
Yeah, it's a cool area. Yeah.
So Brandon, you were kind of just gearing up on the PGA Tour this year. You know, you played Farmers, you played AT&T Pebble Beach. Walk me through how you found out that there was going to be a little hiatus here, that the tour was playing. Your first reaction to that, and how have you been kind of just mentally staying sharp or at least staying positive throughout this?
Yeah, I think it definitely escalated really quickly, I felt like, because we weren't really, you know, talking about it or thinking about it at all. And then suddenly, you know, I think one night I saw the NBA stops and next day, you know, it's like all the other major sports have stopped. And I was like, whoa, like this could really affect me, which is a little unexpected, I guess. But I've been doing well, you know. It's been nice to have some time off, just hang out and kind of, you know, I'm in a very fortunate situation, I guess, unfortunately. Haven't been able to play golf and whatever, but you know, that's kind of the least of my worries at this point. And so for me, I've kind of just stayed positive this entire time. You know, kind of just look at this as like a unique opportunity. I think one of my agent was saying, he's like, you might not ever get this big of a break again. So enjoy it while you have it. And that's kind of how I've been looking at it. So
has there been anything, whether it's physical or mental, during the downtime, the opportunity? Because I agree with you, it's such a rare thing. But has there been anything that you're like, man, I really want to work on that during the break? Or has it been more just rest and get ready for what comes after?
I guess it's more just been rest and what comes after. I think one big thing everyone's kind of been talking about is like everyone's itching to play. So, you know, they could be playing quite a few weeks in a row right when we start up again. So I think mentally preparing for that and physically preparing for that is important. But Also, yeah, I think it's just nice to take a break kind of away from golf. That's kind of one reason I chose to not kind of be practicing and playing through this entire time. It's just, you know, kind of enjoy the other aspects of my life and, you know, put the clubs away for a little bit.
We've been talking to as many golfers as we can over this hiatus. And it's interesting to kind of hear what you just alluded to, Brandon, which is how many weeks in a row you might want to play. Some guys, when they get to like 4 or 5, they got to shut it down. Some guys would like to play a lot less than that. What's like your ideal schedule? And I know it's kind of around, there's a million other factors that go into this, but what's your like ideal schedule of how much you'd want to play?
I guess that's something that I'm still trying to pick up on and learn. I think I feel like the most I've played in a row right now is 3 weeks, which I think for a lot of professional golfers is not even that much. So we'll see. I think there was a stretch last summer where I played a Korn Ferry event in Stonebray and then went down to Peru for the Pan American Games and then straight to the U.S. Amateur after that. So that was kind of that was definitely a little bit more travel than I anticipated. Moving forward, but that was kind of a 3-week stretch and I was definitely pretty tired after that, but so yeah, we'll see moving forward. I think just something to learn and get used to.
I'm looking at your amateur achievements, your career amateur achievements, and there's so many different things here. You've stroke play medalist at the 19 USAM, semifinalist at the Western AM, which is a huge deal, I know, Walker Cup, Porter Cup, all these different things. What's the one that you look back on and you're like, man, that's the one that I'm maybe most proud of, or the one that kind of meant the most to me at the time?
I would definitely say that winning at the Porter Cup was definitely super special, because that was kind of – I mean, I'd won a bunch in junior golf, but hadn't really won since then. I hadn't won in college at that point. And that, you know, being such a prestigious amateur event was super special. And that event is unique too, because – it's held in the same course in the same town every year, and they kind of develop the following. I feel like, you know, the whole town kind of comes together. There's everyone stays in host housing, and you know, it's a big deal for the locals. So that was super special being a part of that, especially being from New York as well.
Now we're basically a year removed from you graduating from Stanford and making this transition to the big tour. And you mentioned like you're learning things, right? You're learning what amount of golf to play. What other things are you learning throughout this? And are you learning it from your peers? Are you just learning it from, you know, trial and error? Like what has this process been like for you?
Yeah, definitely a learning process, like you mentioned. I'm fortunate to have peers like Colin Morikawa and Matt Wolf. You know, they're some of my good buddies, and they've had a lot of success quite quickly out there. And you know, they can really help with that. I remember I played with Matt and Colin one of the practice rounds for Torrey Pines, and Colin, I think I'd just been asking him, you know, like what's it like? Like, what are the biggest adjustments? And he was like, I think for me, it was just getting really comfortable out here. He was like, you know, in college, you know, all the people you're playing with, you've seen them around, you know, everyone, even down to the rules officials. And he was like, for me, it was just trying to get comfortable out here and kind of develop that same camaraderie among the other players. And then he's like, yeah, I knew I had the game, and then everything just took care of itself.
He's like, yeah, I don't know. I've never missed a cut, so I don't know what to do.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to know a little bit about growing up. You grew up in the Northeast for I believe some of your at least childhood. Had some family that I presume played sports as well. Just what was your family life like? Was there a lot of competition? Were you guys moving around a lot? What was your upbringing kind of like as you got into golf?
Right. I actually did move around a lot as a kid. So I was actually born in the Bay Area, a town called Danville, just about an hour away from Stanford. So I lived there for, I think, 8 years. And then my family actually moved to Beijing from there. So I spent about 5 years in Beijing. But we would always come back to California for the summers. That was kind of the best route for golf. You know, there's lots of good junior golf in Northern California. So we'd kind of come back and spend the summers out here. But yeah, I lived in Beijing for 5 years, and then I actually started going to boarding school in the Northeast. I started at a middle school called Eagle Brook, so was there 7th through 9th grade, and then went to Deerfield Academy 10 through 12. And I think it must have been my 9th grade year where my family moved from Beijing over to the Northeast, and we settled down in Scarsdale, New York, and we've kind of been there ever since.
Now, when did you pick up golf in all of this, Brandon? Because we've been kind of asking the same question. Some guys are super late to the scene would be like, 12, 13, right. Which is what we've heard. Some other guys are like, as soon as they could walk, they could pick up a club. Where are you at? Mm-hmm.
I guess kind of in the middle. I think I started when I was about 6 or 7. So when we were in Danville, we kind of lived on a golf course more or less. So it was just super easy. My dad was kind of learning golf at the same time, I guess. I'm not really sure why he was into golf, but for some reason, he's really into it. He'd kind of take me to the driving range of the course, and, we'd both be trying to pick it up at the same time. So that was a cool bonding experience for us.
What did your parents do for a living?
So my dad did his own business for a long time, but he recently started working in investment banking and back home. So I think having his own business helped us kind of move around wherever, because I think he had offices both in California and in China. So, he could kind of just work from home and travel, and he could just move around as a family, and it didn't impact him too much.
Do you think any of that, the kind of moving around and the entrepreneurial nature of your family, was there any of that that helped when you, because I think when you get to high school and the level that you're kind of at, and especially in college, there's a lot of self-starting. There's a lot of practicing on your own. There's a lot of doing your own thing. How much did your upbringing affect kind of the way you participated in that later on?
Yeah, for sure. I think moving around, definitely. Just you got to really adapt to your conditions quickly. And honestly, I felt like it was definitely hard for me as a kid, especially when we moved to Beijing. That was such a different experience going from, I think Danville's a town of maybe like 40,000 people to Beijing, which is super hectic. We live right in the city.
A little bit more than 40,000, I think.
yeah. Just a little though. So that was definitely, for me being 8 years old, kind of just, leaving all my friends and everything that I really knew to move to this one of the biggest cities in the world. And so that was pretty crazy. But it's definitely an experience I look back on and I'm fortunate to have had. I think it definitely helped.
I'll actually take that a little bit further, Brandon. I mean, the way that I look at professional golfers being independent contractors, kind of being their own business, do you think that your family, your father's entrepreneurial background, like, do you talk to him about some of this? I feel like that's a very natural fit for you being like a professional golfer as kind of your own business.
Yeah. I know that's what our coach Conrad Ray would always tell us. He'd be like, when you're thinking about turning pro, it's your own business. You got the keys and everything. And I definitely think my dad has helped me out a lot. I mean, we haven't like sat down and like laid everything out, but I think he gives me small tips here and there that I know comes from his own experience and have definitely helped me as I've come along.
When you think about last summer playing US Open, Open Championship, What were those experiences like? And is there one that obviously you made the cut and played pretty well at the US Open. Do you look back on that one more fondly or just what was your big takeaway from playing in those two events last summer?
Yeah, for sure. I think both were pretty unique and both were obviously very special, but definitely I think the US Open, I guess, although it came first, it was pretty special because I was a first alternate actually for the 2017 US Open at Erin Hills. So I'd lost in a playoff to Cameron Champ. And that was, I guess, the week before you kind of, everyone's like, whoa, this guy hits it really far. He's really good. So I was super close. But that USGA actually made changed the rule that year where first alternates could go play practice rounds. And that was during my exam week. I'd finished all my exams. So I was like, I'd love to go out there. So I, got to go out there and played the course twice. Maverick McNeely, my teammate, was playing there as well. So I played, 9 holes with him, played 9 with Sergio, I believe. That was kind of my like first little immersion into, these guys that I grew up watching and, some of the best players in the world. So, being so close that time definitely made the US Open like really special for me. And I really wanted to make it back. So then finally qualifying this past year, especially at Pebble Beach, right next to Stanford pretty much. And that's a special place too. So super exciting there.
Real quick. So you played Sergio at Erin Hills. Is that just like you're on the 10th tee box I think 10 was all the way out, but you're on the first tee box at the same time, or did you set that up? How does that like take place?
Yeah, I know. I guess an interesting part of the story. So I'd actually played one hole with Sergio before. So when I was living in Beijing, the HSBC would run kind of a junior circuit, I guess. And one year I won that tournament. So the prize, I guess, was you get to play one hole with five different pros at the HSBC cool. Open. So I think I must have been like 10 or 11. I'd played one hole with Sergio. And I clearly remember I had maybe like a 15 footer, and his caddy gives me a read, and he, you know, marks a spot on the right next to the hole with the pin. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, that's too low. Like, I got to play it higher. But, you know, I was like, this guy's a professional caddy. I got to trust him. I hit it. And sure enough, it misses low. And I'd never forgotten that. But to your point, Kyle, was I think I showed up on the first tee. I could only kind of get the afternoon times because, you know, they wanted all the other players to kind of have the morning times. And, you know, for us, it was just like kind of filter in where you could. And I'm standing on the first tee, and I guess Sergio's walks off 18, and he's making the turn because he'd start on the back. And we're suddenly standing on the same tee box, and like, whoa, like that's when I was like, okay, I guess I'm playing nine with Sergio. And I told him the story on the first tee, so we had a good laugh about that.
That's Sergio's awesome. Caddy making sure that you don't beat his guy, right? Make sure you miss this one low. Exactly, don't make us look too bad. Well, let's continue with the playing partner theme here, because I can't imagine many golfers have played around with a former Secretary of State. So you teamed up, right, with Condoleezza Rice at the Pro-Am. I'm assuming it's the Stanford connection, but how does this come to be?
Yeah, so Condoleezza Rice is kind of very involved in Stanford golf, which is super nice of her. She gets to spend time with the teams. And so I didn't really get to know her that well at Stanford. Just we never really overlapped. I guess some of the kids take her class and, you know, through that or get to play with her. But I felt like this could have been a really cool opportunity to kind of pair up with her and play a Pebble. And I was super stoked that it all worked out well. And she's super competitive when it comes to golf, which was really exciting. But I guess I remember, I think I was, she invited me over to her house the night before the first round, and she was kind of throwing a little cocktail party before the tournament started. And, you know, some of her friends are coming up to me and telling me about, you know, like, oh, she's never made the cut. Like, you know, she's like feeling really nervous. And suddenly I was like, whoa, like, what did I sign up for? Like, now I'm a little bit nervous about, like, trying to, you know, get her that first cut or whatever. But it was so fun being out there with her. I mean, she's such a blast to talk to and walk with on the course. And it was awesome to see kind of the support from the crowd as well. You know, everyone loves her and like yelling at her and asking for pictures. So that was really fun.
That's awesome. I do want to go back. I know we're just kind of bouncing all over the place here, mm-hmm. but 2019 NCAAs, you guys beat Texas in the finals. I gotta shout out my Oklahoma State squad. They got beat by Texas in the semis, and that stroke play event, they were unreal. Matthew Wolf won by like five. They had three other guys that were in the top 15 or so. Just what was that run like? Because I you watch some of this stuff on TV and it looks incredibly exciting. There's just a lot of drama. There's a lot going on. What's it like to be in the middle of an NCAA, especially that you go on to eventually beat Texas and win it?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, this year was super special. I think if you look through our past results at Stanford, we've been really good kind of in the regular season. We get to NCAAs and we've really fallen short. I know my freshman year, we were the number one ranked team in the country and ended up finishing 28th out of 30 teams, which was definitely a disappointment. But so I think we were kind of in almost like uncharted territory, even come the last day of stroke play. I'd never made it to the last day of stroke play. And not that we weren't confident in ourselves and, you know, that we could make it to match play and that we could win the whole thing. But it was definitely like, okay, like we're kind of in new territory here. But I do remember that last day. It was definitely playing hard, last day of stroke play. It was playing hard. It was windy. And we were just sliding down the leaderboard. I think we started the day second and we're just like slowly sliding. And, you know, it's definitely on everyone's minds. Like we're so close. And I think we ended up being seventh, which was just good enough.
So when you're in that situation and you're trying to break through, and you described it as kind of uncharted territory, Brandon, is there one guy that you look to? Because you didn't have anybody on the team that had been there before, right? Is that when you rally around your coach? You just rally around each other? Is there a mindset of like, hey, we're the underdog, this is okay? Like, how are you trying to break through?
Yeah, I mean, definitely our coach, Conrad's been there before. So he's definitely a figure we look up to. And then I guess me and Isaiah Slender, we were the two senior captains on the team. I think we tried to be kind of that rallying point. And I think I'd been playing pretty decent through the first three rounds. And I know Isaiah had been playing really well through the first three rounds. So, you know, kind of just continue our hot play and try to lead by example.
Yeah, and then you get into the match play portion. You beat Vandy, you beat Wake Forest 3-2. You beat Vandy 3-2, and then you beat Texas 3-2. I mean, that's got to be insane to where it's like every, because I think so much of that, it's so condensed at the end. It's so compressed into the last like 30 minutes or hour in terms of the drama. What is it? What's that feeling like for that last hour of all three of those matches?
Yeah, I guess the Vandy match was definitely the most memorable for me. But I guess before I started on that, it's actually because you're kind of focused in on your own match and there's not that many scoreboards out there. You don't actually really know what's kind of going on. I guess when I watched it on TV afterwards, you can kind of like feel the pressure and all that, because you can see like, oh my God, that guy's struggling or this guy's doing well. But so when you're out there, you're like, you kind of don't know. And if you don't have a coach floating around with you too, there's not really someone you can talk to about it. But the Vandy match, I think it came down to our freshman Dowlett against, I think, Harrison Ott, I think, from Vandy. But and he'd been cruising, he'd been doing really well. And you know, when I picked it up, I think he was three up with four to play, or you know, so he's close to finishing out. But you know, suddenly he's two up with two to play, and we get to the 17th hole, which is par three. And Harrison hits it way left in the hazard. And we're thinking, okay, like, come on. Like, I know you're a freshman, but the one thing you can't do is hit it in the left hazard. And, you know, there's miles of room, right? Of course, he just hooks it way left, right next to Harrison in the hazard. And they both hit miraculous shots out of there. And I think Harrison's on the green about 20 feet. Dowlett's just off the green about 25 feet. And he's standing there taking practice strokes. And the whole team's watching at this point. And he hits his ball with his practice stroke.
Oh, no.
And we're like, oh, my God. Like, we cannot believe what is happening. Like, this guy was five up, like, half an hour ago. And now he's, like, taking penalty strokes from just off the green. So he ends up losing that hole. And then we get to 18. He hits a great drive somehow. It's a tough tee shot, too. So props to him. And then hits, like, I think, four or five iron on the green about 30, 40 feet and just buries it in front of everyone. And
love it.
That was one of the most riveting moments ever. So very cool.
I think hitting your ball with a practice stroke is called the Zach Johnson around here.
Right.
After what he did at Augusta.
Yeah.
Oh man. So I mean the resume already as a young guy, Brandon, is really impressive. And what I notice is you seem to be in so many like high leverage, high pressure situations. You've played in championships, you've won championships. Like, talk to me about how you deal with that pressure. Are you able to put it to the side? Are you still feeling nervous when you step on the first tee at some of these places? Like, how do you handle your pressure?
Yeah, I definitely still get nervous sometimes, for sure.
That's good to hear. I would hate it. Yeah, I'd be so mad if you were like, oh, no, it's no big deal.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know if that'll ever go away. But yeah, I think you can definitely – I think for me, the biggest part kind of my career, as well as these like pressure situations, is I feel like I've kind of had like a slow build up into these situations. You know, like I'll touch back on the Aaron Hills moment. It's like that was like a – very low stakes moment. You know, I knew I wasn't going to be able to play in the actual tournament, but you know, you can kind of just soak it all in and enjoy the course and kind of learn from everyone else. And you know, I feel like just like small moments like that, and I've like slowly built up, makes like a almost like a stronger foundation for me when I get to these bigger moments. And so yeah, I guess I have that kind of to look back on. But it's interesting, like every moment's kind of unique. I guess you got to just try and focus on what you're doing and not think too much about it. And then, because when you step back and look at it, you're like, whoa, like this is pretty crazy. Yeah, it's like, I don't know if I want to hit this one.
Well, I want to jump in on that, because I'm curious if there was a moment ever at Pebble or at Port Rush last year, where you look around, whether it's who you're playing with, maybe somebody's in front of you or behind you, and you're like, how did I get to, like, how did this happen? Like, how am I in this position right now? Was there ever that kind of like light bulb moment for you, or had you kind of gotten over it by that point?
I think, I guess a little bit I'd gotten over it. I mean, definitely the moments are still cool, you know, but I just, I think it's like been like, those first moments definitely occurred at Erin Hills. I'm like on the green and, you know, Jordan Spieth's like 15 feet away putting, which is cool. And then, but now, I just look at them as kind of like competitors and peers, which is good. But, I mean, I think one fun moment from Port Rush was it was Wednesday before the tournament and the weather was horrendous. It'd been really nice Monday, Tuesday, but Wednesday was like blowing 30 and raining sideways. You know, the crowd obviously is out there loving it. Like, they're lining the fairways, and, you know, which is very, very fun to see. But, and yeah, I think most guys hadn't even played that day just because the weather's so bad. But I had never really experienced weather like that before. So I was like, this would at least be good experience, you know, especially if it comes down like this during the tournament. And I'd play the first seven holes, and I cut over to 16 to finish 16, 17, 18 to go back to the clubhouse. I'm standing on the tee. I just get there. 16's at monster par three. And you know, there's like 3-4 deep in the crowd, all the way up to the green, and up comes Tommy Fleetwood and Justin Rose strolling to the tee. And I'm like, okay, like, I guess going to play the last three in these brutal conditions with Tommy and Justin. And that was super fun, but that was like a whoa moment.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, you mentioned seeing these guys and then they become your peers and whatnot. I feel like the turnover on the PGA Tour, especially with you young guys who are coming up so prepared, especially coming out of the Pac-12, seems to pump out a ton of guys. Like, there's probably a significant percentage of these guys that you know from other points in your career, and that will only get bigger as more and more of you kind of graduate and get onto the PGA Tour.
Yeah, for sure. It's been super cool just to kind of see, I mean, my like circle kind of get bigger, but also like people that I've known for so many different years. And then they're, you know, on tour, and now you see them on TV. And like earlier this summer, watching Colin and Matt Wolf in the last group at the 3M Open was like pretty cool, because I'd just been playing with them a month or so ago at the national championship. So that's been cool to see for sure.
There's going to be some kid in like 15 years who's like, holy crap, Brandon Wu's walking to the first tee, and now I guess I got to play nine with him.
You know, we asked Colin about this a couple weeks ago, because I love talking to other players who, because Rick and I can say like whatever we want about, oh, so and so's swing is amazing,
and we say whatever.
But like, it doesn't carry the same authority as when a player says it. Because you talk to a player and you're like somebody said that, I think it was Justin Thomas said this about our guy Sungjae, Rick, where he was talking about, he's like, look, Sungjae is legit, like he is really good, and because you're also really good, that carries more weight than when Rick says it or when I say it. So I'm curious about, as you've been out there, whether you've gotten around anybody that you're like, wow, this guy's unbelievable, like better than I thought, or just like an incredible ball striker that I didn't totally realize from watching on TV.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure about the didn't totally realize part, but I hit balls at Torrey Pines next to Rory. And that was like, I'm like sitting there, I'm like, what am I doing here? I definitely think there's, and I've gotten to learn, like, you know, obviously I'm confident in my own game. And I think maybe Sean Foley told me once, he's like, there's going to be someone that does something better than you, like everything, you know, like,
yeah,
someone's going to drive it better, someone's going to chip it better, someone's going to hit their irons better. So it's like, if you get too caught up in that, then, you know, it's really easy to get dark on yourself. But, you know, the end of the day, the goal is just to get the ball in the hole, and you can kind of do it however you see fit. But it's pretty amazing watching Rory hit balls on the range.
That's awesome. We're Kyle and I also, Brandon, are pretty big stack guys. You know, we pour over the strokes gain numbers probably more than we should. You know, we keep track of all that stuff. How aware of are you of your own stats?
I guess it's been we used to keep a pretty detailed set of stats at Stanford. My first 2 years mostly spearheaded by Maverick McNeely. He's a he did management science and engineering at Stanford. He's really into big data, and nice. So you know, we're filling out his Excel spreadsheets both for him and for us. I guess
this is music to my ears right now. This is incredible.
He loved that stuff. So yeah, but yeah, I guess it's also nice also playing on the PGA Tour where they do your stats automatically, so you kind of just scroll through at the end of the day. It's like, oh, okay, I did this, and I guess I do follow my stats pretty closely because I think it's a good baseline to compare yourself and see how you're doing. But I also feel there's kind of the intangible part because, you know, I feel like, let's say you go out and play around, you have, you know, like 10 6-footers or 10 8-footers. And it's like, I think from 8 feet, you're supposed to be about 50-50. But, you know, you know you've left a few out there and you can kind of just feel that. And I don't know if the stats really show that. So,
well, you know, you know that, like, if you hit it where you wanted it to, right? Like, was it a misread or was it a miss hit?
Right.
We'll never know that. We just know you made it or you missed it.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And I actually think one really interesting comment that I was playing with Nick Price, actually, I think sometime in the fall, but we were kind of just talking, and I think it was a wedge number, and I just hit it, you know, or like he's talking about, like, you know, sometimes you aim like a flagstick right, even though it's a wedge, and you hit it right there. You know, often I was like, oh, like I should have just aimed at the pin. Like, why didn't I just aim it at the pin? Like, that would have been so much easier. But he's like, you know, like, actually, like, you know where you're trying to hit it and you hit it exactly there. That's a perfect shot for you. So it might not necessarily be like an inch from the hole, but, you know, you hit it exactly where you're trying to do and you put yourself in a perfect position. So I thought that was an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that speaks to why stats are a lot, but they're not, they can't be everything, because you have to marry it with other stuff as well. I love the left a few out there, by the way. That's like my favorite thing in golf is when Patrick Reed shoots a 64 and he's like, I left like 5 or 6 out there. I'm like, wow, that's aggressive.
Right.
tell me real quick, and I know we're going to get to a break here in a second, but just what being a student at Stanford is like to me as an outsider. I did go to Oklahoma State, which I bring up on like every podcast. I don't really know why, but Stanford's compelling. It's obviously great school, great athletics, great academics, beautiful location. Was it everything that it appears to be from the outside as a student athlete there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I enjoyed my time so much. I mean, I thought it's probably in my mind the best combination of both. You know, you got high level golf, but also just world-class academics as well, from everything from the professors to your peers and your other students. So for me, yeah, it was so cool being able to go to school there and kind of just experience all that in one.
I love it. Well, Brandon, we've been debating this week a couple of golf terms or things that are said that maybe they should be said differently. So we want to get you to weigh in on them. But first, we're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Did you know that while over 60% of Americans dream of starting their own business, less than 20% of them take the first step? The reason? Building a business is tough. Taylor Brands is simplifying the business journey. From launching and managing to growing your business, Taylor Brands isn't just another tool. It's your online business partner from launch to success. With Taylor Brands, building your dream business becomes an effortless experience. Their comprehensive platform guides you through every step, ensuring you have everything you need in one place. From LLC formation to bookkeeping, invoicing to acquiring licenses and permits, and even setting up your bank account, Taylor Brands handles it all seamlessly. and our listeners will receive 35% off Taylor Brands LLC formation plans using our link, taylorbrands.com/CBS Sports. That's TAILORBRANDS.com/CBS Sports. So start your business journey today with Taylor Brands.
And we're back. All right, Brandon. So we went over this with the full First Cut crew, Mark Immelman, Greg Ducharme, earlier in the week about some of these. So I've got a couple of, you know, kind of rapid fire type questions for you. So we'll start with this one. Not necessarily verbiage, but if we made you commissioner of the PGA Tour, actually even more than that, you are king of golf now. You are in charge. And you can change one rule, add one rule, remove one rule, anything you want about the game of golf. What would that be?
Wow, interesting question. I haven't really thought about this one before.
So I'll give you an example. So we had Cheyenne Woods on. She said that you could have one mulligan at any point during a tournament.
That was awesome. I love that one.
Which imagine coming down Sunday, you know, Sunday afternoon, if you still got your mulligan in your pocket, you're probably feeling pretty good. Kyle wants to have the Ryder Cup every year. Okay. What was mine? I forget.
Maybe twice a year. I don't know. I mean, every year might not be enough.
I forget what mine was, but that's the type of stuff that has generally come out of this.
Yeah. I mean, kind of on the Ryder Cup lines, I'd love to see more team golf in one way or another, because I think, college golf is an easy avenue for that, I feel like, but maybe something beyond that. But I've gotten to play on a couple teams, both in college and like the Walker Cup team. And it's so exciting. And I think that's definitely something I missed as a kid. I felt like, you know, playing golf as an individual sport, you know, all my friends are running around the soccer field or playing football. And I think it would be awesome just to have more team golf in the sport.
Yeah. I think there's an opportunity.
That's a good one.
Yeah. More formats. I want to see more match play. Yeah. Let's let these guys do it. Play a 2-man scramble. Like, let's go see how low they can go. I don't care. Let me see cool stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, and here's one for you. And this got pretty heated the other day. Can golf be a verb? Can you say I'm going golfing, or do you have to say I'm going to play golf?
That's an interesting one, because I want to make golf sound more like a sport, I guess. I'm trying to think the other sports, like I'm going to go play football or play hockey. So I guess I would say like you have to go play golf. You can't just go golfing.
Because you can't go footballing, right?
Yeah, you can't go footballing, no.
You can go hooping, though.
Hooping,
yeah. That's a good point.
I'm probably too old and white to be talking about this.
We're trying to make a push. I realize that I use them fairly interchangeably, so I would have to make a pretty big commitment to say I'm going to play golf.
Yeah.
As opposed to I was golfing earlier, so we'll see how that goes. I think this one's pretty straightforward, but I want to hear from the mouth of a pro here. Albatross or double eagle?
You know, it's actually interesting. I've been kind of reading, just articles online. Now I'm thinking it must have been your guys' article.
Oh, boy.
But I think it was saying, like, double eagle is unacceptable. So I'd probably go with albatross anyway.
Kyle, is double eagle unacceptable?
Yeah, it's nonsense. It doesn't even, I mean, let the Stanford guy tell you what math is. I mean, it doesn't add up. Like, it's dumb.
It doesn't add up because a double eagle should at least be 4 under par, right? If an eagle's going to be 2 under. All right. Speaking of which, here's the trivia that I just learned the other day, Brandon. Do you know what a hole in one on a par 5 would be? So 4 under.
It's not a double eagle.
A bigger bird of some sort, maybe, I'm assuming.
Yes, it is.
Condor.
Yes, it is a condor. Okay. Look at this. This guy,
the biggest bird I could think of.
The guy from Stanford. He just critical thinking. He just got it. Yes.
That's like straight out of the SAT playbook, where you don't really know what the answer is, and you just reason
have
your
to
way.
Take a guess.
Yeah. I can like eliminate one of these answers, and I can make an educated. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. That's so good. Okay, Brandon, do you call them sand traps or do you call them bunkers?
I go bunkers.
Always bunker.
Yeah, is that I'm not is that the more technical term? I think it
I
don't is, remember.
I think it's the more like European British like British term. I think that's what Mark was saying the other day, Rick. So gosh, I think it's more proper, I guess.
Yeah, and Mark Immelman, you know, he does the broadcast, so he has like what you're supposed to say on the broadcast. You know, you're not supposed to call them whatever. I would forget that in an instant, but Mark knows them all. This one, so you've played a lot of match play. You college guys get a lot of exposure to it. Is a match tied or is it all square?
I'm more comfortable saying all square. I thought. It was in like the new rule change that they made it tied, I guess. But I mean, I feel like everyone's still pretty comfortable with square.
Yeah, it's good. Good take.
That's what we say. I think they did change it to tied.
To tied.
Someone higher up on the food chain making the decisions than us, but we prefer all square.
All square. Right.
Kyle, remind me how you felt about this one, because this is kind of a two-parter. So we've got alternate shot versus foursomes. That's one side of it. And then better ball versus four ball. Kyle, where did we land on this?
Yeah, you and I were both alternate shot, because that like makes sense. Yeah, it like describes what's actually happening. And then four ball, because better ball, I think you could verbiage your way to where that was actually alternate shot. But like four ball, there's always four balls in play.
Right.
So alternate shot and four ball is where I landed.
Okay. Brandon, what do you think?
Okay. I definitely agree on the four ball part. I guess the alternate shot part, I guess I'm more opinionated towards foursomes because we've been calling it that, I guess, you know, for like the Walker Cup. And I played over at Mirfield a few times this summer, which is just such a cool experience. But they basically almost exclusively play foursomes, which is, I guess now thinking back to the whole King of Golf scenario, I think that's actually really interesting, because we would play rounds in, you know, like 2.5 hours or so, and it's four people, you know, two can walk ahead, and, you know, golf's suddenly really fun. It's kind of a team sport, and, you know, it's a good time for everyone.
I like that.
Maybe we could have a foursomes major. That's what we could have, and two winners or something like that. That'd be pretty
cool. I think that's called the Zurich Classic, actually.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I just gave it major status, I think. All right, Brandon, last one for you here. The British Open or the Open Championship?
Ooh, I would definitely say I've tried to say the Open as much as I can, but it's confusing even for me. So I don't know if I can do that. So I just go British Open.
Okay.
Interesting. So we've been, we're also a little biased on this. Well, Kyle more than I am, because he's got to post all the articles on CBSSports.com, and there's like, what are they called? Like you got your guidelines, Kyle.
Yeah, you got to do like all this SEO stuff for people searching British Open versus Open. There's like, I was telling these guys the other day, Brandon, we had a conference call where Nick Faldo was being interviewed, and he was like, we keep shortening it. He goes, it used to be the Open Championship. Now it's just the Open. It's going to be the in, you know, like 3 years. We're just going to call it the, which I thought was hilarious. But I like Open. I like anything that's shorter. Is better for me, because I have to write fewer things. So I like the Open.
Right. The Open.
Yeah. All right, Brandon, are you more active on Twitter or Instagram?
Instagram.
All right. Go and give Brandon a follow on Instagram and Twitter too. I believe it's BWoo97 on both, right?
Yes, sir. That's it.
I gotcha. We'll get you those followers. You can also follow Kyle at Kyle Porter CBS. You can listen to the First Cut podcast on all your smart speakers. You can follow us on Twitter at First Cut Pod. Brandon, really appreciate you coming on today. Thank you so much, and good luck when golf comes back.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having me. Enjoyed being on the podcast.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Brandon. All right. This has been the First Cut. We'll see you next time.
We'll be right back. Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sample, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.